fan. On demand. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Sign up to automatically receive the latest reports, features, and Fan 590 show highlights. The only sports personality you can truly believe. This is Primetime Sports with Bob McCowan on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
First time we played Judas Priest on this show? Might be, huh? Yeah, it's all Request Wednesday. I don't know if this was a good idea or not. That's for Fred. There you go, Fred. You ask for it, we give it to you. Wednesday, the 23rd of April, 2014, Bob McCown, the coach, Butch Carter. A little later, Matt Devlin, the Raptors play-by-play voice, will join us. Also, Jesse Katz of LA Magazine on Yusiel Puig and his story. Alleged story about the people behind his arrival in America. Very interesting. And who's he beholden to? Don Banks of Sports Illustrated will be with us. And the coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning, eliminated last night, John Cooper, will join us in just a few minutes. Butch, how you doing? Okay.
Good. How you doing, Robert?
Hanging in. You know, just doing what you got to do for a Wednesday afternoon. So last night, the Toronto Raptors got what you hoped they would get. I think both you and I were sort of the same mind. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I thought after game one, if the guys that they need to perform, they can beat Brooklyn. And last night, and principally, DeMar. And last night, DeMar had a big fourth quarter, made a bunch of free throws. Racked up 30, and the Raptors are even going to Brooklyn.
Good for them. They made the adjustments they needed to make. Playoff games, to be successful, have to become extremely personal for players. And I think that DeMar crossed that bridge in the fourth quarter. It became extremely personal to him, and he took it upon himself to clean it up. And he was strong enough that with what he did, and what the rest of them did, it combined to a good win.
It's really tough. And you talked about, you know, your early playoff performances with Vince and how he struggled in his first few games. It's really tough to win when your best player, he doesn't have to shoot lights out. He doesn't have to be superhuman. But he has to be close to what the expectation is. Yeah, it's almost impossible to win if you don't have that.
He has to be close to what he did in the regular season.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go in and you've got, you know, an all-star player and he shoots 30%.
Yeah.
Right?
You're going to lose almost all the time.
You are, because it forces B players to try to become A players. And then it screws up your rotation with the other players. And, you know, the pressure builds. If anyone says the pressure isn't real, you know, they're not telling you the truth.
Right. And it's understandable that over the course of 82 games, guys will jump up and have big nights. But it's what they do on a regular basis is what you're counting on. You got to the playoffs because you expect guys to perform in a certain way. In the playoffs, the chances of B guys becoming A guys is a lot less. There's not as much room. Things happen faster on the court. Guys are intense for 48 minutes. There's no breaks, really. Nobody's taken a possession off. And they do that, quite honestly, in the regular season. Guys do take possessions off.
You have to, because you fatigue.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but I agree with you, Robert. It's your guy needs to be who he is. In the history of the NBA playoffs, there are very few guys who've gone from B players to A players. You think of Robert Horry, Sam Cassell.
There's a handful.
And after that, there's a steep cliff.
Yeah.
And when you look at them not shooting any free throws, I believe in game one, the fourth quarter, and then what they did last night, they did not play particularly well. The coaching staff did make the adjustments that they needed to make. And the guys that they needed to make shots made shots. I think both coaches have done a good job to get one game. I think Jason had his guys ready to go in game one. Pierce makes shots, but Pierce is an old guy. He's going to go through games where he doesn't make shots. He's done that during the season. He got a couple open looks in the game, and to the Raptors' benefit, he did not make them. They've been a high turnover team, six above per game, above what they've done during the regular season. But they got through it. They found a way to win. They found a way to get one. They've been a good road team during the year. So I think we have a series. But they say a series never really starts until you win on the other team's court.
Yeah, they got to go through that. But it's all little hills and a few mountains that you got to climb over the course of seven games in order to get there. You talked about turnovers. I mean, this team has had 40-some-odd turnovers, I guess, in the first two games. As a coach, what, if anything, can you... First of all, what can you do to mitigate it? Or maybe first, what do you think causes that? Is it nerves? Is it the pace of the game?
No, because I watched Chicago-Washington last night, and the officials call a different game. I mean, you can flat-out get raked on the arms, and you got all
the... The Chicago series, they called it differently than what you saw with the Raptors.
I mean, there were turnovers with the ball being raked from guys... And you would have thought that Ray Charles and Jose Feliciano were officiating the game. and that's just the way it is. And what happens in the playoffs is the other team does a good job of taking you out of what you really want to do on the first side of the basketball. And so then that leaves you trying to play one-on-one and drive 20 feet. And in the playoffs, no one's except an awesome player is going to be able to drive 20 feet and get to the basket. And so that's where you see a lot of the turnovers. We talk about what JV has done, but JV has also had high turnovers because there's been lots of times they've raked him. You know, he didn't get the call. But, I don't think it's something bad. I think it's something that can be cleaned up. You're really talking about five or six possessions, and that's really not what's costing them wins. It's causing them to be inconsistent. But the ability for DeMar to be at the free throw line, your all-star player, making shots, driving the basket is extremely more important, I think, than anything else.
Well, the turnovers are mitigated to a certain extent by the Raptors' dominance on the boards, at least it was in game two. And so Brooklyn is not getting as many second chances as the Raptors are getting. Do you expect that to continue? Should the Raptors' dominance on the boards continue?
Yeah, because historically, Brooklyn helps off of JV, so JV can rim run with no contact.
Right.
Right? Now he's matured enough to understand, oh, it's wide open for me to go to the basket.
Yeah, I can gain position.
That's correct. When you see a guy fall down, bounce the ball off the backboard, lay on the floor and catch it, for a rebound?
Yeah. You know he's got time.
He's got time and space. So I think if you look at the analytics over how Brooklyn has, JV has always been a really good rim runner. He was awesome when he was younger, playing off the bench. He deals with a little fatigue now. But I'm so happy for him because the young man had run into an issue, and I talked about he needs to validate who he really is through his play. Because sometimes as a player, things go wrong off the court, and the only place that's your safe house is that basketball court. And so he has come back and validated himself and validated his value. I think that was one of the things that DeMar did. I was also very happy for Landry Fields because he tricked Joe Johnson two or three times, and the Raptors needed him to trick Joe Johnson because Joe didn't know exactly what to do with him. And he had him, Joe, thinking of doing things that he isn't supposed to be doing. And those possessions were extremely important in a high turnover game.
Fields was a forgotten man on this team.
Yes, it happens because all of a sudden you've got a young Ross who's guarding and can make a three, so it provides a certain amount of spacing. Fields has an injury to his arm that I don't believe allows him to shoot the basketball past a certain distance consistently.
Mm-hmm.
So that may work itself out over time, but he's always been a fast twitch, high energy guy. And clearly he gets the benefit of the doubt with his mental process and his physical skills in guarding a player like Joe Johnson. And Ross doesn't. You know, I think one of the ways to clean that up is that we used to use Doug Christie to guard whoever the best offensive player in the smalls.
Mm-hmm.
But I helped Doug Christie because what I did was I went to the press consistently said Doug Christie is an all-league defender because the officials read the paper.
Yeah.
Right? So you need to kind of self-promote what a guy does to help him out. All right? Because everyone gets so enamored in, you know, what's going on in the offensive end, who's scoring, who's your all-star. But in reality is that there's always a sacrifice guy.
Well, and fouls are a function as much of reputation as they are of act.
But they are. And then you take someone as young as Ross in the playoffs, and his attitude is that Joe Johnson looks like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and he's going to eat him alive. And the official's standing there saying, hey, young fella, hold up, you got to wait till lunch before you eat.
Yeah.
But when you see a young guy getting back-to-back fouls, he's got himself in a tough spot.
Back to Valanciunas. In an age where dominant big men have almost gone the way of the dinosaur or dodo bird, and I don't mean there aren't any, but there aren't an abundance of them. And I'm not here to suggest that Jonas Valanciunas is anywhere near being that guy. But you got a pretty good read on what players can be. Not what they will be, but what they can be. Can he be a dominant guy?
Well, I think he can be a dominant guy. He has to change. They have to change his workouts. Because right now, the scouting report for the playoffs says he hurts himself because he catches the basketball on the baseline on the right side of the court.
It doesn't have anywhere to go.
He can't drive with his left hand.
Yeah.
So the baseline is his friend.
Yeah.
Right? But everybody forgets that the backboard sits out 3 feet.
From the baseline.
From the baseline. Right? So he's snookered.
Yeah.
Right?
He's stuck. He has nowhere to go.
Correct. So if he caught the ball further north of the baseline, all right, but he needs to have the ability to drive left and right.
So he's got to work on that.
Yeah, even if it's
how uncommon though is that with a young player still that really is one handed.
It's totally common.
Right.
It's totally common. All right. It's a teachable moment.
Yeah.
All right.
Got to work on it, and right. You got to work on it over time.
You can pull the analytics of every possession he's taken with every game, and then you basically what I would do is you're not practicing. Get on there with your workout guy, all right, and clean this up. Because it would mean so much more if he could maximize. Because all you're talking about with Jonas is improving his efficiency,
mm-hmm.
right? And the best way to improve his efficiency is if they see you on film drive 2 times and dunk with your left hand.
All of a sudden, the analytics change.
All the analytics change and the official's opinion change.
Ah, yeah, sure.
Right? Because everybody forgets, all right, that the Zebras have watched the greatest players. They've watched top 50 players play and compete. And they know exactly what those top 50 players could do.
Yeah.
And then they watch guys come along who can't drive left, go right, and then are trying to scream foul and they're shooting behind the backboard.
Yeah.
So to me, I would define his future on what the top side is in two areas. Make him more ambidextrous.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so he's more efficient, and then we've got to figure out what's going on with his conditioning, because I've said all season, you know,
runs out of gas.
Yeah, and see, if he went to college, what you would do is just run him in and out every 3 or 4 minutes, no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with the pros is one, you've got coaches that never coached in college, and understand that when you got a young player, things have to be handled differently than if he's a veteran. All right, there's no medals for a guy staying out there 10 minutes when he can only play 6-minute spurts.
Yeah.
All right, so his efficiency, you know, if they put him in took him to a Nike training school, they put the breathalyzer on him and says, tell us where he maxes out at, all right? And so then, you know, that's how you determine his intervals,
mm-hmm.
all right? One of the great things that I always heard was the great Indiana team in 76 was defined in conditioning by one thing. If Bobby Wilkerson was tired, he knew the rest of them were exhausted because he had this great stamina.
Yeah.
That he could run everything that Knight would force him to run and laugh at him. It just didn't bother him.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you have to know the limitations. And so with JV, the future, I think, is very bright because I think the five hole in the East is going to be empty for a while. All right. Unless the kid from Kansas ends up in the East. But I think the five hole is going to be empty if he becomes extremely more efficient with both hands, and he and the coaching staff figure out what is his max efficiency, all right, and don't overplay him on the max efficiency because he's young. He is a franchise asset, and you don't overplay a franchise asset for a coach's own personal gain.
So if I'm reading you, there is a chance that he can become better than good. He can become dominant.
He should be an all-star center.
Yeah.
In 3 years, he should be an all-star center. Shouldn't be any question on it. You walk out, you should be able to count on him for 18 and 10 because he makes his free throws. Most centers don't make free throws. Not only does he get fouled, but he makes his free throws.
Mm.
So that's a huge asset. You can play him in the fourth quarter because he makes his free throws. He's got to get better defensively, but, you know, there are techniques that could be taught to him to learn to defend the pick and roll better. But he's playing with a really good young group.
Yeah.
They should be good together.
We'll talk more basketball in a few minutes. Matt Devlin, the play-by-play voice of the Raptors, will join us a little later. Jesse Cates of LA Magazine and Don Banks of Sports Illustrated will be with us. Hockey fans need not be reminded. Last night, the Montreal Canadiens swept the Tampa Bay Lightning four straight with a 4-3 victory last night at the Sandra Bell, or Bell Center, if you will. It was interesting would be the word, I suppose, season for Tampa Bay. It featured the loss of one of the best players in the world for 4 months, the trading of the captain, and then going into the postseason without your number one goaltender. All of that, I guess, at the end was a little too much to overcome. The head coach of the Lightning, John Cooper, joins us. John, it's good of you to join us tonight. We appreciate it greatly. This series of things that happened that I just mentioned over the course of the year, did they add up? Was that part of the factor in the team's departure so quickly? Or is it just as simple as, if you don't have your number one goaltender going into the playoffs, boy, that's an uphill climb?
Yeah. I think there's probably a lot of factors into everything that went on. Just first and foremost, you got to give credit to the Montreal Canadiens. We played them four times in the regular season, and they were good games, but the best four games they played against us were the four in the playoffs. And it was... you know, we had a little bit, I think, our D had a little bit of trouble with their speed. And you get back there, and Carey Price is you know, he's world-class. I feel that if you get three goals against Price, it should give yourself a good chance to win the game. And we did that a couple times in the series. But our biggest deficiency is we couldn't keep the puck out of the net. And that was a big goal of ours coming into the season, as we were the worst team in the league a year ago with the goals against. Mm-hmm. I think it was 3.06 we gave up, and we're always known as the scoring team, but it really doesn't matter how many you score, it's how many you keep out, and we just couldn't do that in the playoffs. And I think there's not 1 ounce of excuse I'm going to sit here and say, you know, the fact that we didn't have Ben Bishop in the net, but we just played with a different confidence when Ben was in the net.
Sure.
And I think as for a young team, it was kind of he was kind of a security blanket for us. And when he was gone, I think it surely showed that we struggled without him.
Well, this is a team that was what, 28th overall in the National Hockey League a year ago. So, and I think people tend to forget that and look at the performance of this team over the course of this year. In spite of the things that happened, especially with Stamkos going out for an extended period of time, certainly your best player, arguably the best player in the world right now. And you overcame that or you dealt with that, or this team did. And so I think the expectations actually were more related to the team's overall performance this year rather than the tremendous steps that you and the organization took this year where maybe you should have expected, well, it's going to take a little bit more than 1 year to turn this thing completely around.
Yeah. It's amazing to sit back and look and think we had 101 points in the regular season. I'm
exactly.
still blown away that we came third in the conference. And the one thing is, I think, I don't know if this was good for us or bad for us, but we seemed to play at a high level the entire year. Like we went through stretches where we lost a few games here and there, but we didn't really go into those couple weeks where you're just scratching your head, where is our team? What's going on? It would just be maybe a game or two, and then we'd be right back up, playing at a pretty high level. But I think when we did that, I think we had a lot of youth and exuberance, and I think we were so gung-ho to try and win every single game. And I think in the end, we may have wore ourselves out.
Mm.
And once you've been through the 82-game grind and then get to the playoffs and the emotional strain and everything that goes on, you kind of have to be in there to feel it, see it, be a part of it before you can really, digest and react to it. And I think it was a big step for a lot of our players. It's a shame that the season we had, I think, is a what have you done for me lately league. And so, people soon forget that you came 28th the year before. You haven't made the playoffs in a couple of years. You weren't picked by anybody to make it, but all of a sudden now, you have home ice, you should be a favorite to win this series. And
right.
I feel for our guys because, to be honest, I think Montreal deserved to win the series. I think we had to fight some obstacles in the last couple of games. But I think teams make their breaks, and we just couldn't make our own breaks. The one thing is, it's just a tad little bit embarrassing to go out in a four-game sweep. I'm sitting here, it's Wednesday afternoon, and a week ago today, the game one was just about to start, and so it's tough to go out that quick.
Coach,
I think you're extremely lucky because your best player, one of the best players in the world, did not re-injure himself. And I think that's a huge help for you so that you can go and plan through the summer, know what you got in training camp, and allow him more time to heal because – it could have went the other way. He could have stayed out for you. You'll get your number one goalie back, and most things you got to go from good to better to best. And hopefully that's the way you feel.
Oh, there's no question. And I think I'll be honest. The game four we played last night, that was one of the best games I've watched Stevens played since he's been back. And we've had to play him at the wing for quite a few games here in the past, just because. I think it was a lot of a mental thing for him. He's been cleared by every doctor and everything about his leg. But when you have something kind of that traumatic happen to you, I think it's the same way for guys that blow out their knees, that it takes a little time for them to get back mentally. And I think that was the same thing with Steven. But this summer will be good for him. I think he'll come back and be rejuvenated as ever. And now he's our new captain, and we couldn't have a better guy doing that. We're really excited. It's crazy. It's 4 or 5 months away, but really excited for next year to start.
Did Montreal do anything differently in the playoffs? You referred to the four games you played against them in the regular season, and you were certainly competitive against them. Did they do something different, or did they perform at a higher level, in your opinion?
I don't know. I'm sure they performed at a higher level for sure. I think they kind of had their team going. I think they came into the playoffs healthy. But the one thing they did is they didn't spend much time in their zone. And instead of probably, in previous times we played them and they try to make plays out of their zone, like the second they got it, they just slipped it out. And that caught us off guard a little bit. Because they had some speedy forwards out there that, sometimes weren't completely coming back into the zone, and they scored a couple goals off that. Rene Bork gets one in the first 10 seconds of the game of Subban, instead of just making a play with the puck, he just flipped it out, and they just, again, they got an unreal bounce where it bounces between our guy's leg and Bork goes in all alone, and it kind of stretched us out a little bit, and it took us, a couple games to adapt to that, but overall, I thought they played well. They played hard. They had all four lines going, which was a little deeper lineup than we could provide. And when you really come down to it, when you have Carey Price in the net and you've got Markov, Subban, Georges, and Emelin as your top four guys playing 25 minutes a night, and they're playing at a high level, it's pretty tough to penetrate.
You said you know, a week ago you were getting ready for game one, and here you are contemplating plans for the summer. Have you?
Thanks for that.
Well, what's...
No, I'm just joking.
I mean, it's the reality of it. I mean,
I know, it totally is.
Have you?
It's, that's the crazy thing. You start, I remember, you know, camp starts in beginning of September, and you go through all these things. Like, the Steven Stamkos injury seems like three seasons ago.
No, I hear you.
And then you know, people forget the Olympics, and then the Marty St. Louis situation, and him, he wants to leave the organization, and just it's amazing that this all happened in 1 year, and then you work all this time to get to the playoffs, and it's like blowing out a candle. That's how fast.
Yeah.
You know, if you get swept in the first round, that's how fast it's over, and that's the tough part to take, because you know, we got off the plane today, and we'll see the guys one more time tomorrow, and then that's it. Basically, the same guys I spoke to in the dressing room will never probably have that same 20 year again.
Well, I'm sure you'll spend the next few months thinking about what happened this year, the good and the not so good. And we talk about young players learning from the experience of being in the playoffs for the first time. But you and I were just talking about the Toronto Raptors, and they're as a group going through it for the first time. Do coaches learn something from this experience, do you think?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Do coaches learn something from the experience of going through the playoffs for the first time? Is there a learning curve for coaches too?
I think there's always a learning curve. I think a big part of this whole process is every year you get better as a coach, you learn something new. I've been through these playoffs before in the American League. I've been through seven-game series. I've been through
different
things. And there's always experience, but... The NHL is a different beast with everybody watching in the media, and it was great to go through. It was great to go through for the first time.
Well, listen, I know the summertime is a little longer than you'd hoped it would be, but enjoy it. I know that there's lots of work to be done over the next few months, as well as a little breather. Congratulations on a great season. We wish you the best of luck in the future, and hopefully we'll have a chance to chat on numerous occasions down the road. Thank you for today.
Hey, thanks for having me, and I appreciate your time.
John Cooper, the head coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning. It's not often that a coach will come on less than 24 hours after he's eliminated from the playoffs. So
I thought it was awesome.
I think it talks about the character of this guy. And particularly the fact that it's while this is a national show in Canada, this is a guy who's the coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning. If he's going to do something on the day after, you know, he'd probably do it with his own home radio station, which he may very well also be doing. But to do it for us, I think, tells you a lot about his character. And a guy who's not bitter, quite cheerful.
No, he knows he's got another fight ahead of him, and he's disappointed that he lost the last fight, but. It seems to me that as soon as he spends a little time with his family, there's going to be a lot of video, and I imagine he'll sit with his boss and raise his hand and say, "Hey, boss, if I had a wish list, this is what I wish for."
Well, and who would know that better than you? You probably called him at 3 o'clock in the morning and said, "Hey."
It's not that. I just think that if really good staffs, they try to get ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
The only advantage they have now is that the good teams aren't doing much personnel stuff. So you might as well bury yourself in it.
That's true. They're busy trying to win.
That's right.
Trying to win games.
Right. So you're busy trying to catch them.
So here's a young team that collectively, and I don't know how many guys on this roster, not many, had any playoff experience. They go out in 4 straight. They're very young. They went from 28th in the NHL to 3rd in the East in 1 year. Mm-hmm. Nobody expected this, but now you get swept in 4 straight. Would one playoff win have meant something to this team, or is that always overstated?
I think it's overstated. I think what I would do is that I would find out when the next round of the playoffs are. I talk to all my guys when they exit and say, "We're going to pay to send you to the next round of the playoffs." And have them go in there and feel it and see it.
Interesting.
But they don't get to eat it. They just get to
look at it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right? Because the reality is that, like I said, successful playoff teams, the playoffs become very personal to the players.
Of course.
And so, you know, what we did after the first year was we sent all of the guys to the second round of the playoffs, paid for everything, and they found it to be quite embarrassing.
Mm.
Why you're in town? You're not in playoffs. So I'm just a firm believer because I watched when we were in the playoffs my rookie year, Isaiah came out, all right, and the whole time he's sitting there, his mind is turning on, I want what these guys have. And that's how it works. You know, if you go back and you want to put them in a position where they're in town and they're checking in the hotel, what are you doing here? You're not in the playoffs.
You don't want to let them just walk away from losing and shut off what happened completely and go right into cruise control mode.
Right.
You want them to think a little bit about what they could have had.
Right. I want to send them into the environment and see what the environment.
Really
if
interesting.
If you want them to play in it, I think they have to taste it, feel it. And if they're not playing in it, then they need to watch and see the other teams play and be angry about it and understand when they get there that this is the venue that you wanted to be in and nothing else matters. And I think now they go into a summer with a purpose.
That's really interesting. We'll return to basketball and specifically the Raptors, although with maybe some other stuff. Matt Devlin will join us next. He's a play-by-play voice of the Toronto Raptors. With the coach, Butch Carter, I'm Bob McCown, and this is Primetime on the Sportsnet radio and television networks.
Prizes like no other, from a club like no other, the Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Well, we don't even have to wait for Bono to sing That's Pride or In the Name of Love by U2. That's for Steve Kennedy on All Request Wednesday. You think crowd affects officials?
Yes.
So the crowd at the ACC last night was not only loud, but they were on the officials early and often.
Except for the first 5 minutes of the third quarter.
And what happened then? Oh, they weren't in their seats?
They're down the suites. I mean, it shows up so clearly on high def.
I didn't have it on at the beginning of the third quarter, so I didn't see. I thought they were all. I thought we were past that after you got into the postseason. Once you get to the playoffs, even the suits managed to get back to their seats in time.
Game one, they were super, but
game two, they fell back into their old habits.
Game two, they were back to form.
Here's the voice of the Toronto Raptors. Here's Matt Devlin. Hello, Matty. How are you?
I'm doing great. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. You're in the building last night. It's loud. They're on the refs more than they were in game one, really, at least from the beginning, because of what happened in game one or the perception of what happened in game one. Do you get a feeling that the officials are influenced, intimidated, at least aware of what's going on?
No, I think they're definitely aware. I agree with Butch. You know, I think that there are certain, you know, officials that, you know, when you're on it all the time from a crowd standpoint, I think that that does become a factor. And the crowds the last two games have been off the charts. And I agree with Butch outside of the first. In fact, I just got a call from a couple of buddies of mine from New York. They said, where was everybody at the start of the third? But, you know, you and Butch knows this. Not only that, but then also, you know, the coaches. And it's the combination. You know, I think we've all seen that in sports, and it's not only in basketball.
I just think, you know, the reality is that the officials are subject to Mo. If you can get Mo going, if you can get the team going,
yep,
the right plays, the right shots being made.
Yeah, they fall in line.
They're more likely to cooperate than go the other way, except Dick the Nick.
Why him? He's just on his own planet or what?
Bavetta is the only guy that I seen Kareem smile about on when they asked who the officials was on a road game. So, I mean, Dick, if you're on the road, you don't mind seeing Dick because he got no problem shoving it right up a good crowd.
Well, I guess when you've been around as long as he has, you know, you get curmudgeon-y.
I agree. I mean, but, you know, you weren't going to intimidate Dick anywhere you're at.
I hear you.
Yeah.
We've talked a bit about the differences in, maybe a lot about the differences, Matt, in between game one and game two in terms of Raptor performance. I think Butch and I both were kind of the same opinion that you know, if they played their game in game two, they didn't get the performances from, you know, their big guys in game one. If they got the performances, they didn't have to do a whole lot more. They were good enough to beat this team. Well, they got that performance last night. Yeah. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think the big thing, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, you guys may have talked about it, was bringing in Landry Fields. I think having Landry Fields come in and get after Joe Johnson, to me, was a major factor in the game because, you know, one of the things you talk to people that, you know, have been around Jason Kidd this year as a coach, they said one of the great things that he does is, as he did as a player, he can recognize who to get after. And when he looked at everything, he saw that, hey, let's go pick on DeMar DeRozan defensively. And they went to him, and it was Joe Johnson, and then it was Allen Anderson. It was the combination of those two guys. Dwayne Casey recognizes it. He brings in Landry. He was certainly the unsung hero of that. And I think, you know, that also then freed up DeMar DeRozan from an offensive standpoint, and he was, you know, outstanding in that fourth quarter.
Matt, I agree with you. I think I was happy for Landry Fields because he was able to validate that he still has value. I know he's been through a tough season with his injury. But I think I think from a perspective of what you do every night for the team, I thought that DeMar went to the next level in the fourth quarter. I thought that he was extremely disappointed when they took him out of the game because they had to. He had five fouls. Coach made the right call to get him back in the game. And then I think he went to that extremely angry level, but effective angry, and did what he needed to do. And I think he was a man on the island. I think if his own teammates would have gotten his way, he would have knocked them out.
You know what, Butch? I wholeheartedly agree. We had a shot of him at the end of the bench by himself. In the juxtaposition of him and Andrew Wiggins, who may be the number one overall pick, who's laughing and, you know, kind of enjoying the moment, and you see the depth of the look and the stare of DeMar DeRozan. And DeMar, the one thing about him is that he is a quick study. He understands. And I thought, I completely agree with you, he rose to that next level. And for him to do that in only his second game is certainly something. I mean, to get to the line the way he did, to make tough contested shots, you know, those tough twos that went down, they were certainly big time. And you know how difficult that is when you have an entire defense, because Kyle was struggling. You look out there, you have, you know, different components. You know that you got to get it. And when all is said and done, when everything else is, you know, not going, you know, do you have a guy that can get it? And he was able to be that guy in that moment.
I thought it was extremely important because he is, I believe, the heart and soul of the franchise. He's the worker. He's the overworker. He allows the guys to be who they are in the locker room because he's not doesn't carry a superstar ego. And when I was looking through some stats this morning, what he did in the fourth quarter, I think there's only been two other players who've done it the last 10 years. They're named LeBron James and Kevin Durant. And so what he did in the fourth quarter, they've done it a lot more, but what he did in the fourth quarter for his team for the first time, categorically comparing him to his other peers, is in a special class. And, I think he should be recognized for that. And you've seen him through all the stages, and so I wanted to hear your comments on that, please.
Well, you know, but I think you put it perfectly. I actually, You know, I had the opportunity to vote for all NBA first, second, and third team. I put him on third team, and I had a chance to see him play every single day this year. And I think, you know, he was deserving of that honor. When he's been criticized with respect to, hey, you got to get to the rim more, you got to do this more, you know, one of the things he's been able to do is match that. And, you know, this year he set a franchise record in free throws made. You know, he was a first-time All-Star. His work ethic is, he's a gym rat. And, you know, you said it perfectly, and you're around, you know, him on a daily basis as I am. He is just a kid that loves playing the game. And I think he understands, as you well know, reputations are made or broken in the postseason. And I think he was, in talking to, you know, people around him and in talking to him after game one, it was, you know, kind of a sleepless night for him, because he recognized that, you know, all of a sudden I got to wait now 48 hours before I can get out there and do it again. And he recognized that moment and he grabbed it.
Do you think there's anything, guys, let me ask you both this question. Are we ever going to, are we at a point, have we been at a point, will we get to a point of an unfair comparison with Vince? Who was clearly a superstar at in his time, very special player, arguably the best player in the game at that time, arguably. But the number one guy for the Toronto Raptors in this market, in this country. And DeMar is clearly that guy now. Are comparisons unfair, but are they inevitable?
Can I have a first shot at this?
Please? Sure, go.
I think that players define what they do at the time they do it. And Vince did for the franchise what needed to be done. I mean, we were coming from playing in the baseball stadium.
All right? Yeah.
I mean, it was a completely different time compared to where the organization is at now. And DeMar, at times I've been critical of him because I wish at times he was more athletic, even though he's extremely athletic. But my benchmark is pretty high.
Yeah.
But to be quite honest with you, when he dunked with his left hand last night,
that's pretty good.
He told Jason Kidd basically to sit your behind down because you're in my house. All right? I mean, he sent a man's message to real men.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, you can do any more than what he's done right now. I mean, I just think with what he did last night and comparatively what he does for his team, you know, give him the time. Give him another 2 or 3 years and see what he does. But I thought that he really jumped from the fourth quarter to prime time with what he did in the fourth quarter last night.
Interesting. Matt, your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think it's inevitable, but I don't know if it's fair in the sense that, and Butch knows, I mean, you know, Vince is half man, half amazing. I mean, you know, completely different in that vein. I mean, he activated not only Toronto and Canada, but all of North America with what he was able to do. And DeMar is a different player in that light. And, you know, Butch touched on it earlier. I mean, he's not a... You know, he's just a guy that it's almost like, you know, he just comes to work every day. And I agree with that move to the rim. It's interesting what you were mentioning that, Butch. It stood out. I had a conversation with Chuck Hayes, and Chuck and John Salmons both say, you know, they sit back and they watch DeMar and they don't know if they've ever seen a guy that goes from just kind of the, you know, he's just kind of there and it's kind of sleepy a little bit. And then all of a sudden,
boom, it explodes. Yeah. Maddie, we got to go. I hate to cut you off, but we're dead out of time. Thanks a lot, Matt, for joining us. Matt Devlin, the play-by-play voice of the Toronto Raptors. We got another full hour to come. Stick around. This is Primetime Sports Coast to Coast on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.